From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Everybody, and welcome to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I'm Hunter Deucing, returning for week two of What Rock Month. Back with us, making his, second in a row appearance, is Stuart Balk, back from the dead, again.
Hello.
With his voice. Yeah, you wouldn't know from there, but he has his voice back. I blew mine out singing karaoke, so I sound a little...
I was just trying to impersonate Mike Patton there for a second.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway. Hello, everybody. It's on my head.
Do you have a creeper stash going?
No, I'm not allowed to have one. I'm personally vilified... Yeah, I ridiculed in public if I had one with my wife, so no.
Yeah, Mike Patton, he rocks the creeper stash, or the creeper goatee.
Not as good as our friend John Waters, but no. Nobody does that.
No, nobody does as good
as Steve Buscemi.
Steve Buscemi. Yeah, this week, for week two of Rock Month, Stu picked Van Halen last week. This week, I picked the group, and it's... the group we're trying to be talking about, in case you haven't guessed, is Faith No More, which features Mr.
Actually,
Mike Patton.
You know what? I put out a few clues out there, and only one person actually got who it was.
Really?
And I will give a prop to Mr. Craig Cohen of the Slycast. He did pick it with a very, very minimal amount of hint that I put out in one post. But Craig got it. Well done, Craig.
Yeah. I put a few pictures up, too, of one of Kurt Cobain reading a magazine with Faith No More on the cover. And one with James Hetfield drinking in a Faith No More t-shirt. But
I'll bring up James Hetfield a bit later. Don't worry.
Okay. Well, it's funny because Faith No More, they're from the San Francisco Bay Area, like Metallica.
Mm-hmm.
And they were both kind of playing in that scene at the same time. But they started out as a band called Faith No Man with Wade Worthington on vocals and guitar, Billy Gould on bass, and Mike Borden on the drums. And when that band fell apart, Billy Gould, my mind's splattered. They got together a band called Faith No More, and they got Roddy Bottom on the keyboards. And after a few guitarists, one of which was Mark Bowen, and the only reason that's notable is they had a song called Mark Bowen. they got Big Jim Martin on the guitar, the riff master, Big Sick Ugly. And they went through a bunch of vocalists, including Courtney Love.
And, oh, really?
Yeah, Courtney Love sang in Faith No More for a bit. I've actually heard audio of her singing live with them, and it's not very good.
I have an aside for that, the usual John Grace history note, because you remember back during the height of Lollapalooza when Hole was on the Lollapalooza tour or doing a lot of tours in the early 90s playing to big crowds? She, Courtney Love, used to go on these weird stage draps where she'd probably say too much. And nowadays would easily get her banned from everywhere. But she said that when she slept with Robbie Bottom, she said she turned him gay, basically.
Yeah, she said as much in her VH1 Behind the Music or whatever.
Yeah.
She talked about singing in Faith No More, and they actually interviewed Roddy Bottom. But she said she was sleeping with him, and she got the gig singing in Faith No More. But, yeah, he later came out as gay in the early 90s.
You know what, though? I must say, for the guy who's gay, who comes out and says he's gay with a name like Rod Bottom, I couldn't have picked one better than that, really.
Indeed. Yeah,
the fates were in the cards.
But eventually... eventually, they got Chuck Mosley on the vocals, and who was apparently... an interesting frontman to see live. Apparently, during early shows when they would play War Pigs, Chuck Mosley would refuse to sing War Pigs and take a nap on the stage.
Gee,
while the audience would have to—they'd have to pick up the slack with the audience to sing War Pigs. But yeah, you could often see James Hetfield at their shows, and he was good friends with them. And you know, he appeared on Jim Martin's solo record, and Jim Martin appeared on Metallica's Garage Inc. So,
okay.
That's a little segue I've got with Hetfield. When I was reading fanzines and stuff back in the 80s, early to mid 80s, there was a band that was notorious around there, which was a little cobbled together band that would play every so often, very rarely, called Spastic Children.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Now, that was a combination of a guy named, they called Mad Fred Cotton on vocals, Cliff Burton on bass, and James Hetfield on drums. And the guitarist in that band was Jim Martin,
mm-hmm.
who I didn't know at the time. I only knew of Burton and Hetfield. And when I was doing a bit of research for this show, I read up on Faith No More, and sort of Jim Martin was in Spastic Children, which is a horrible name for a band. I always thought it was a terrible name, but it was something that was done when I was horribly drunk as well at the time. So,
well, and,
yeah, I realized, wow, he was in that thing. I remember reading about them about 30 years ago, just about.
Well, you can actually, I think there's footage of Jim Martin and Cliff Burton at like a high school talent show or something you can find on the internet.
Yeah, I think they were friends from like high school. Yeah,
yeah, like the song Surprise You're Dead off of The Real Thing is something Jim Martin wrote when he was in that band.
Oh.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I hope he didn't write it for Cliff Burton. That's a horrible tribute.
No. This was before Cliff was... Yeah, this was when Cliff was still alive, pre-Metallica. But so, yeah, Stu, you hadn't really listened to much Faith No More, right?
No, only one album, which was The Real Thing.
Yeah, that's with their most famous record.
Oh, yeah, that was huge.
Yeah, and John was telling me about how big it was too.
Now let me just interject there for a second. Correct me if I'm wrong. I remember hearing a few people back in the day say that they preferred Chuck Mosley over Mike Patton. They didn't like Mike Patton in Faith No More. Does that sound right?
I've read. Think there's a website called Faith No More blog, and mm-hmm. I mean it's one of the best fan sites I've ever seen. They like have such meticulous. Things where they pick out like magazine articles and any fanzine, like everything, and just interviews with everybody, and you know they give the latest on every side project anybody who's ever been in Faith No More is up to, and they were talking about how one of the guys there said when he bought The Real Thing when it came out, that was his first exposure to Faith No More, and he started dressing like Mike Patton and like.
No, no.
English people would give him shit because they were like, trying to look like Mike Patton. He sucks. Faith Chuck was better, you know?
that was the height of the whole you sold out, you signed to a big label bullshit that mm-hmm. was going around the music thing. Because I had friends who, like I had one friend who had their major label debut with Mosley on the on vinyl. And he was like, no, man, the old singer was better. And it's just because, oh, they're popular now. So we have to act like the older singer was cooler when nobody listened to them.
Right.
When the skater kids listen to him, because it's all that listen to him in my hometown.
And, you know, I got to say, actually, I actually share the sentiments of some of those guys. I prefer Chuck Mosley over Mike Patton as a vocalist.
Well,
I don't dislike Mike Patton. I think his range is excellent, as what his abilities. But I just as a vocalist for that band, I prefer Mosley.
Well, they're two totally different vocalists, too.
Oh, I mean, completely, yeah.
But we'll get to that in a bit. But so their first album is called We Care a Lot, and it came out in 1985, and it was an independent release. It has Chuck Mosley on the vocals, and did you guys get a chance to listen to this one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard all their albums, yeah.
What'd you think?
We Care a Lot. I didn't particularly care a lot for this one.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't like it either. I was surprised it even made a mark for it.
I mean, this is a this is not a very widely heard record. It's not even in print anymore. You can't buy it on iTunes, on any of the MP3 sites. It's pretty tough to come by on vinyl. And I think the band thought of it as kind of a glorified demo. They didn't really think of it as a I don't know about the band, but it's kind of considered to be a glorified demo tape. But, I mean, a lot of the songs, some of the songs on it are still in live rotation. Like, I have soundboard recordings of Mike Patton singing songs like Mark Bowen and As the Worm Turns. I think those still get performed live. Yeah, We Care a Lot does, too. But
see, it's interesting you mentioned that, because the Live at Brixton CD... I don't think had As the Worm Turns, but the video did.
Yeah, the video did, mm-hmm. And they released an audio version of it on the This Is It, The Best of Faith No More compilation.
Okay.
Right.
I got to get an audio of that, because I actually enjoy that cover a lot.
Yeah, it's really good. But, I mean, I actually, this is a record I didn't listen to a lot, but I listened to it from cover to cover for this show. It was probably the one I'd listened to the least. And I listened to it cover to cover, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. My favorite songs were The Jungle. I like...
I hated that.
And I like Pills... not Pills for Breakfast, although that's kind of fun. Arabian Disco is pretty cool. It's kind of a post-punk album, really.
Yeah.
You know, it has that kind of post-punk vibe. Keyboards, guitars, you know.
Well, I can see why they call it a demo, because it sounds like it lacks production.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It just doesn't have any kick to it.
Absolutely.
Nothing's heavy. It doesn't really grab you, especially if you've already listened to the rest of their discography.
Oh, yeah.
And if you go back and listen to that, it's like, oh, okay, they're on their way, mm-hmm. You know. Yeah. But it sounds like a demo tape.
Yeah, it's not gonna blow anybody's mind. But it's kind of an album that I think is for fans only, really.
Yeah.
You know, it's not one to start out with. Like, a lot of bands, you want to start with their debut album. This one, not so much. No. I do enjoy it quite a bit, but I'm a pretty huge Faith No More fan. I don't know, kind of maybe a little bit blinded by it, but it has a lot of throwaway on it. Like, you know, Jim Martin track is kind of, well, you know, Pills for Breakfast. But all right, so sounds like you guys weren't too hot on this record. What rating would you give it, Stu?
Me, I'll give it 3 out of 10. I really did not like it. Yeah, I really didn't like it. Apart from the opening track, which is great.
I'll give it a 2. It's I'm deleting off it. I'll never listen to it again. It just wasn't that good.
I would give it a 6.
And also, I should note, I'm not a fan of the Mosley.
Okay.
So
Mosley, you know, the thing about Chuck Mosley is he cannot sing. Like, Chuck Mosley's appeal is all attitude. Like, He's very atonal. He's very warbly. Yeah. But I like him quite a bit on the next record. But he's very he's kind of I don't want to say an acquired taste, but when I first heard him, I did not like his stuff when I first heard it.
The problem is he's a punk vocalist, and the idea with a punk band is they can't play, but the problem is all the Faith No More guys are really good musicians. So it doesn't It's got a bad effect on my ears, especially around the time when I first heard him, which was after I got Epic. So
yeah, I heard his stuff after I heard Mike Patton with them, and it's very different. But
I should note anyway with We Care a Lot that if you want a used or let's say sorry a new CD version of it, it has been released on CD back in 1998.
Oh really?
Oh, 1996, the first time, 1998, the second time. 1996 is going to set you back $75 for a used one.
Mm.
The 1998 import will set you back $173 for a new one, or $19 used. Or in January 2014, Amazon have now got this album for $8.99 on MP3 if you want it that bad.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, man, last time I checked, it wasn't available, so scratch that. Yeah. You can get it.
Yeah, We Care a Lot, Faith No More, January 14, 2014, on Amazon.com, $8.99.
Yeah, I'd say this is a fans-only affair. If you really like Faith No More, especially the album Introduce Yourself, go back and check it out. But, you know, word of caution, these guys didn't like it. I like it, but I don't love it.
If you're a completist, I'd say.
Yeah, if you're a completist, like I'm definitely – I'm a guy
for the diehards.
I'm a guy who downloads soundboard recordings of their live shows. So, you know,
it's for the diehards.
Yes. So next, they released. They got signed to a major label. They got signed with Slash. And they released "Introduce Yourself" in 1987. Mm-hmm. And this album has the same lineup, and it was produced by Matt Wallace, Steve Berlin, and Faith No More. And Matt Wallace would be a producer they'd have an ongoing relationship with. But yeah, so this song, this album kind of, I guess, introduced them to a bigger audience. Yeah. Yes, the single major singles are We Care a Lot, which was reworked for this album, and Anne's Song, which was a single. It had a video, but it actually didn't chart, from what I understand. So yeah, what do you guys, Stu? This was your first time hearing this one.
Yeah, the only thing I've heard before.
Oh, that's right, Epic.
Was the real thing, and this actually turned out to be my favorite Faith No More album.
Yeah, so you like this one?
Oh, very much.
Yeah,
very much.
I love the riffs on it. Like Jim Martin's just crushing it, and I actually like Roddy's keyboards quite a bit. Adding some atmosphere, but what did you
think? It reminds me kind of like some Europop
sound
that's crept into there, which I really liked.
It has a kind of this variety. You have this kind of these sort of funkier songs like Anne's Song, but then you have like these heavier stuff like Chinese Arithmetic and Death and the Crab Song, which has some great
Crab Song.
Martin.
Yeah,
that's got some great Jim Martin shit on there. But in fact, We Care a Lot almost sticks out on it because it kind of doesn't feel like the rest of the songs on it. But
I see what you're saying. It kind of does, but it's not a bad inclusion.
No, it's fun. I mean, I thought they improved the song quite a bit. What do you think of this one, John?
I don't care much for it. It's
really?
There's nothing outstanding about it that I would go back and listen to it a lot. I mean, the song We Care a Lot is good, but I prefer the versions they did later live and such. I just don't care for Mosley as a vocalist. I think he wasn't a good fit for the band. It doesn't surprise me they were signed to a deal because Slash Records was signing bands like X and the Blasters and these kind of off-kilter groups that, you know, that style, it makes sense. They were pushing it at what was then called the college music scene.
Right, it was quote unquote alternative music.
Right, it wasn't even called alternative in 87.
Yeah,
it was called college music or imports. If you went to a record store, it was in the import section. They wouldn't even categorize this with the regular stuff. But the only kids I remember listening to this stuff were like skater kids.
Yeah,
and it was big with the skaters. Wasn't big outside of that. Metalheads didn't listen to this stuff. Punk guys really didn't listen to them. Punk guys didn't care for them. And the metal guys didn't really like them that much either. And when we get into Epic, there was a bit of a contrast in between old listeners and young listeners around that time. So. But I like the song We Care a Lot, and the version on here is decent, but it's just, it's not an album I revisit.
If you don't like Mosley as a vocalist, it's really,
right.
These two albums are not going to connect with you, especially the first one, but this one as well.
It's an issue there. I wouldn't mind hearing the stuff he did with Bad Brains. I haven't looked it up yet, but
yes.
I do remember when he was a singer for Bad Brains for a year or two.
Yeah, he said he played like around 80 shows with them. Mm-hmm. But they never recorded anything.
Right.
So like Chuck Mosley shortly after this was released was actually booted from the band. Apparently during their release party, he fell asleep on stage.
Yeah.
Apparently
he had a drug problem.
Yeah. He liked to party a little bit more than the other guys. And
he might have narcolepsy and they just being
things
about it.
He apparently was, a bit of a party or like to do a lot of drugs, and it started to affect his performance on stage. And I think they were thinking, we're just now getting big. This guy's a liability. Let's get rid of him. But he went on to, I think he like went and he was a chef for a while, but he joined.
He went to being Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2 as well.
Yeah. What?
He was in Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2 after that.
Really?
Who that was Bill Moseley. Sorry, wrong one.
I was about to say, where was he in that movie? Was he cut out like Joe Bob Briggs? But yeah, he sang in Bad Brains, and now he tours with his solo group, Chuck Mosley and the VUA, and on their album, like Roddy Bottom appeared on there. Apparently, and he's played with the band since, doing a couple of songs with Mike Patton.
What Chuck Mosley should do for a bit of retribution, like 25 years later, is just chuck Rod Bottom out of the band.
Apparently, so I think he's the one he's on best terms with.
Oh, is he really? Okay. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I think they're all still friends. But it just, I think felt he was a liability at the time. And although I heard that, like when they were touring Europe, that the band would like attack each other in the press. Jim Martin referred to Chuck Mosley as an angry pimple between a hooker's legs.
Jim Martin's stock just went right up for me, I tell you.
Okay, so introduce yourself. What do you guys rate it, Stu?
It's a 9.
9. Good choice. Yeah. John?
3.
3? Damn.
It just hasn't aged well. I wouldn't go back and listen to it.
I like this album more every time I hear it, personally. It's a 10 for me. I love this record.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite. I have it on vinyl and everything. I love it.
Of course you do.
Yeah. So after Introduce Yourself, they kick Chuck out, and Jim Martin heard the demo tapes for a band called Mr. Bungle, which was fronted by a very young Mike Patton, and gave him a ring to be in the band, and Mike Patton joined up. I think they had pretty much written all the music, and Mike Patton came in and wrote the lyrics and recorded it.
That's what I read. I read back when this was out and getting big.
Yeah, and so I mean, he was like 18 or something. He was very young when they did this, and he looks young. And his vocal style, like to me, like Mike Patton joining Faith No More, in exchange for Chuck Mosley, it's a lot like when Iron Maiden traded Paul Di'Anno for Bruce Dickinson. You're getting a more of a limited punk vocalist. It's like a band that outgrew their vocalist. When you listen to Killers by Maiden, Paul Di'Anno just doesn't feel like he's on the level of everyone
else.
He's
the weak point. Yeah.
To Killers and it's like, man, they need a better singer. I mean, I love Paul Di'Anno on the first Maiden record, but he's the band has exceeded him. And so they got Bruce Dickinson, who has a much wider range. And Mike Patton's just a completely different vocalist like Dickinson was.
Well, he's an actual vocalist.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the difference.
He can sing.
Actually sing. The other thing that becomes apparent in Epic and also in the album and also the follow-up album, Angel Dust, is he's very inspired by R&B and funk.
Mm-hmm.
His singing style is more like what was typical of a soul singer at the time.
Yeah.
And I think there was a lot of dispute in the metal magazines, because I used to read those, where they were talking about, like, his bandmates were making jokes. They were like, yeah, Mike's really obsessed with disco. It frightens us. But the thing is, he was studying, like, the vocal, the vocal ranges and the use of enunciating and singing and everything. It's like, it's very, the fact that they did a Commodores cover is no surprise.
Yeah. Like Mike Patton, like the entire band, when they talk about the music they listen to, it's all like stuff you wouldn't expect. It's not, they're not listening to their peers.
Well, Patton was photographed for Rip Magazine. He had like a Mariah Carey CD on his hotel bed.
God.
And like a disco box set. So it's like he was looking for different ways to sing, compared to everybody else at the time.
Right. I mean, and like, half of his solo records are him just vocal experimentations. That's all
right.
They are, especially the early ones. But
doesn't he have a band out these days? It's kind of like a super group of some sort.
Are you thinking of Tomahawk?
Yeah.
Might be, yeah.
Tomahawk has members of the Jesus Lizard. And maybe you're thinking of Phantomas.
Phantomas, that's the one. Yeah,
that's got Buzz from the Melvins. It's got Dave Lombardo from Slayer and Trevor Dunn from his other group. Trevor Dunn's in Tomahawk as well, but he played with Patton and Mr. Bungle.
Because I think someone was saying, I think it was William Shatner, so he liked Phantomas a lot.
I love Phantomas. It's probably my favorite of Patton's side projects. The director.
I think I liked what I heard, which for me with Mike Patton is I don't hate the guy, but I think when people if I hear another person say he's a musical genius, I'm going to punch him in the fucking face. Seriously,
Mike Patton's kind of like a Frank Zappa or something, where like half of his albums are going to most of them are probably not going to appeal to 99% of people, but there's some great ones. I think
he's got his audience.
I don't think it was a musical genius, but I think he's a talented workaholic.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, sure. That's how I would define him. He's a workaholic with a lot of talent.
I love the interview where he's being interviewed at some music festival and Wolf Mother's playing in the background.
Yeah.
And he's talking about like all the projects he's working on. It's like he just keeps listing off things. I'm doing an album with Dan the Automator. I'm working on a soundtrack for a film. I'm doing another, Phantomas record. He's just like listing stuff off, and then he just stops in the middle and he goes, "Are y'all fucking hearing this?" And he goes up to the camera and he points and he goes, "Wolf Mother, you suck."
They are freaking awful. They got big here for a little while, like about 12-18 months, but not long after that. That was a pure implosion right there. That's due to that egotistical son of a bitch vocalist. I can't forget his name.
Okay. Here's my Wolf Mother tale: is I saw them at a small venue in Denver called the Bluebird Theater and loved them because I like the album. And then when I saw them 4 months later, they played the Fillmore because they were getting huge. They were one of the worst bands I'd ever seen live.
Yeah.
Really?
It's because the singer seemed—I don't know if he was stoned or was just getting pretentious—but they were stretching their songs out forever. Every song was stretched out to 15 minutes with endless solos and singing, doing the Robert Plant thing and just stretching it. The first show was tight. Like, every song was tight and they rocked out. And the second one was just, I was bored.
Was it they started to believe they were geniuses or something?
Yeah, they believe their own hype. And
No. I don't blame the other members in the band. I blame that idiot. I forgot his name. He's an absolute twat. That's what he is. And now look at Wolf Mother. Now they're doing. They're gone. They've been plugged two albums.
I didn't hear about them. Yeah.
Well, they've disbanded. He kicked out the first two. He kicked out the original members after the first album. Got a couple other guys in. Then booted them out, and that was it. Well, Wolf Mother's dead. Well, the world still turns, my friend. We don't need you.
It's like the Vines. The fucking Vines.
Oh.
I saw them, and the singer seemed to be in such contempt of the fact he was even playing live. He was intentionally singing horrible to drive people away. It was just terrible. Like, he was completely blown off stage by the Living End and Jet, who opened for him.
Oh, my goodness. Living End. They're Melbourne. They're Jet, Melbourne boys, both of them.
Yeah, really? Yeah. It's like those guys opened for the Vines and were way better. And then the Vines are so awful that one guy just shouted, "Hey, didn't you guys open for The Living End?"
I actually got a tale about The Living End. When they first started, like about 95 or something, they played to an audience of like one or two, and I was one of the two there. Uh-huh. And the main guy, Chris, the singer, guitarist, it was his girlfriend was there. I think it's his wife now or something like that. And I was walking out and she goes, "Oh, what do you think of Living End?" I said, "God, they were fucking horrible." And just saw her face drop. I didn't like him at the time. I wasn't very fond of them. I did appreciate them a bit further on. I got what they were doing, that whole rockabilly thing. That was like that huge rockabilly sound back in the 90s. There was like a mini sort of resurgence of it.
Like Dave Vanian did a rockabilly record.
Yeah. A lot of that came from that – who was that damn artist? What was his name? He was huge in the rockabilly scene.
Elvis?
No.
Robert Gordon?
No. He had Dr. something. Like, I can't remember his name.
Unknown Henson.
No, I can't remember the sod's name. I can't remember
the name. The Cramps?
No, it wasn't the Cramps. No, there's a band I wouldn't mind talking about fucking the Cramps any day.
Mm-hmm. There's a great Cramps cover band here in Dallas called the Gorehounds. They're amazing.
Yeah, we have one called the Fireballs, which is a rocket, a psychobilly band. They are awesome to watch. Probably because they have mohawks the size of like three-story houses. They were massive. Actually, the drummer in that band, Joe, was the original drummer in Living End before they got rid of him. And got the other guy in, yeah.
But all right, so the singles off this album were From Out of Nowhere, Epic, and Falling to Pieces. And the track Epic, like, if you go up to somebody who's, you say, oh, Faith No More, and they say, who's that? If you just briefly hum the Epic chorus, they'll know who you're talking about. Like, this is their biggest song, you know. But what did you guys think of this, Stu, with Mike Patton joining and everything? What do you reckon?
Well, I only ever knew them with Mike Patton when I first heard them back in 89.
But, you know, when you're going through all the records, you know.
I'll tell you one thing. I didn't even do any research when I first started listening to them this week or the week gone. And I popped on We Care A Lot and introduced yourself. I said, Jesus Christ, Mike Patton sounds different. Honestly, I really didn't know. And then when I did a bit of research a few days later, when I got a few minutes to myself, I thought, oh, it's a guy named Chuck Moses. I actually quite like him better than Mike Patton. So I'm thinking, where's that whiny, high-pitched voice that he started out with on The Real Thing? But, I mean, I'll tell you who's a fan of that song, Epic, who actually loved that song, was my dad. He goes, this band's got a good sense of humor. I quite like it. It's a true story. he must have seen something funny in Faith No More at the time. But, yeah, he really dug that song. Yeah, I like this album, actually. I think the first half, it's a lot stronger than the second half or side two, what would have been at the time.
Right. And the vinyl and the cassette and the CD were quite different. On the vinyl, the album ends with track 9, Woodpecker from Mars. But if you get the CD or the cassette, you get War Pigs, the Black Sabbath cover, which I could do without, and Edge of the World, which is actually in the middle of the record on the cassette, from what I've heard. But yeah. Anyways,
I had the cassette in 89. We were still buying cassettes, and nobody bought vinyl. Mm. A lot of stores didn't carry it, so I bought the cassette. I played it like endlessly and pretty much wore it out.
Yeah, I think I had it on tape, but I didn't buy it on tape. I had a backup somewhere along the way. I think I might still have it somewhere sitting in a drawer. That's all. I don't expect all my mom made that much money on that album, so they can miss my 13 cents. It's a big deal.
Well, what was it? It was funny, actually, when they were being interviewed by magazines when the album was blowing up, when Epic was, like, you know, charting real big, they said that they were bitching. That they were like, we don't see any money, only airports.
Yeah. Well, it was huge. Like, it was really big. At one point, it really looked like they were going to be the biggest band going. Like, Rip Magazine put out newsstand specials of just photos of them. Like, they were getting that big.
Oh, I should.
It was kind of that pre-Nirvana explosion of that kind of alternative metal thing,
right? Where you could kind of get the first whiff that people were getting tired of just constant hair bands.
Yeah, you didn't have to dress up like a New York Dolls imitation, and you didn't have to wear gay S&M spikes like Judas Priest, you know, and dress up like bikers
or Dee Snider.
Right? They look like skaters and, you know, sort of pseudo hippie guys out of the Bay Area.
Like, and everybody in the band had this, like, really, you know, straight, like, Mike Patton was always, like, shirtless, and he had this, like, really long hair and, like, a baseball cap. You had Jim Martin, who wore two sets of glasses, like, red spectacles and sunglasses, and he had this massive beard and this crazy, you know, biker look.
And yeah, the image was different. The funny thing is, I remember the Red Hot Chili Peppers were hating on Mike Patton.
Yeah, there was actually a massive feud that started.
Yeah,
they thought
he
was imitating Anthony Kiedis, and supposedly the story goes that the Chili Peppers were on the same festival bill as Mr. Bungle, and they refused to play because Mr. Bungle was on the bill, and this is in Europe, so Mr. Bungle came out and did this whole set of Chili Peppers songs.
Well, what happened was, okay, so what happened was is Mr. Bungle started getting kicked off, like the Chili Peppers wouldn't play, so Mr. Bungle would get kicked off. And so Mr. Bungle started, they did a Halloween set where they dressed up like the Chili Peppers.
Yeah.
And so, like, they would come out and they would sing Chili Pepper songs. And Mike Patton was dressed up like Anthony Kiedis. Like, he had a wig on, like, with bleach blonde hair and his shirt off. Trevor Dunn was dressed up like Flea, and he had his hair done like Flea's.
I would love to hear some of those shows.
Oh, that you can see them on YouTube. And
I'll look.
For this was my this was actually my introduction to Mike Patton. Was a an ex girlfriend said, "This is hilarious. You got to watch this," and showed me those videos. And I went, "Who is this guy?" and the guitar player for Mr. Bungle, Trey Spruance, was wearing a sheet, and it said Hillel Slovak. And Mike Patton goes, "Trey Spruance is the ghost of Hillel Slovak."
Okay, I got a whole page of them on YouTube. So
yes, and Trevor Dunn was pretending to shoot up heroin in the middle of a set. I mean, it is so insulting. And Anthony Kiedis heard about it, and he got mad. Like, he started blocking them for more festivals.
Fuck him. He's a prick anyway.
But Mike Patton's talked about it. He said, "I don't understand. Like, we broke before the Chili Peppers did. So, you know, I never even heard of the guy, you know?"
It's true.
Anyway, just to backtrack a bit, I've got to say this before I end up forgetting about the artist I was trying to think of before was the Reverend Horton Heat.
Oh, yeah. They're from Dallas.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah. All right. He actually got banned from coming to Australia. No promoter wanted to touch him anymore because he was meant to come out 3 times and he bailed every time.
Really?
So all the promoters said, screw it. Yeah. Yeah, no more.
Huh. I wonder why that is. I mean, I don't know much about them. I just they come from the Deep Ellum scene here in Dallas.
I've seen them a couple of times, but kind of would forget that I saw them. And it's like, oh, wait, I've seen those guys like 2 or 3 times.
I only know a couple of their songs, and of course, one of them is Psychobilly Freakout, you know.
Yeah. But, yeah, I say Rockabilly. They're definitely Psychobilly more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But yeah, they play here quite frequently. But this was definitely their biggest record. And I like most of the songs on it. I like From Out of Nowhere. Epic's fun, and it's their biggest song. It's not my favorite on the record. I love Surprise You're Dead. I think The Real Thing's a pretty cool epic, like not epic, but like it's a cool, like kind of long, heavy song. You know, Morning After Woodpecker from Mars, not great.
Yeah, the second side really falters a lot.
But I mean, you know, Underwater Love is kind of a strange one. But you know, I have the vinyl and it doesn't have War Pigs or Edge of the World, but I don't really miss those songs.
Yeah, I remember you saying last episode on the Van Halen one. Yeah, you didn't miss those songs. You didn't miss War Pigs at all?
No, not really. I mean, I don't think it's a terrible cover. It's just it just doesn't fit with the rest of the record when I'm listening to it.
It sticks out, right.
Yeah.
I honestly am so burnt out on that song. It's boring, no matter who covers it. And it's like Stairway to Heaven. I love the band, but I don't like the bigs.
War Pigs is not one of my favorite Sabbath songs.
And like, Bohemian Rhapsody as well.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just, if you're going to cover a Sabbath song, cover something, you know, nobody else touches, you know?
Do the Wizard or something.
Yeah, the Wizard's great. There's a cover of that Boots would have been perfect for it.
You know? Yeah.
I did like the Cardigans version of Iron Man. That was different, at least.
Yeah, that was pretty decent.
Was it the only cover of War Pigs that I thought was at least interesting, because they did something different with it, was Cake's version of it, but it's very cakey, so if you don't like Cake, you'll hate it. But
I actually wouldn't have admitted I listened to Cake at all.
I like it better when Ice-T samples War Pigs on some of his rap albums.
All right, I've got to say, Garrow asked, "Where's that body count episode?"
Yeah,
it's not coming.
Yeah, we're not listening to all of those albums.
I ain't listening to any of those albums. They're complete shit.
Body count, motherfucker.
Body count. Yeah, Beatmaster V. Take these motherfuckers to South Central.
BC,
Ice-T. Well, what I did on my body count. What I did on my vacations. Ice-T body count. That's what they are.
Body count.
Have y'all listened to their second record, Born Dead?
No.
Ice-T must have spent about a day on the lyrics for that record. Because half the songs have like, it's like that body count song where it's very repetitive or non-existent. Like, it's just
It's about the projects, y'all motherfuckers. I bet this was the whole thing's about, you know?
That's where all the headbangers are.
Yes.
In the projects. In the ghetto.
Hey, yo, talk shit.
Dallas.
Get shot.
L.A., home of the body bag. South Central.
All rise for the Los Angeles National Anthem.
Yo, go get yourself some knowledge. Get some
where
books.
The Crips and the Bloods play. I ain't new to this. We got to do New Jack City.
Oh, absolutely.
We should totally do New Jack City. Nobody else is talking about it.
I went to watch New Jack City in the theater when it came out, and I saw the poster. And I thought, wow. And it had Ice-T in it. I thought, wow, Ice-T, great. I had no idea who it was, but I liked the name. And for the whole film, I thought Wesley Snipes was Ice-T.
You were like, this dude's charismatic. He should play Blade.
Yeah. I'm thinking that Tom, who's this dreadlocked idiot with Judd Nelson in the film? It's, oh, shit, that's Ice-T.
Oh, yeah, whoops. That's Ice-T. Yeah. All right, so the real thing, what rating would you give it, Stu?
I'll give it 7.5.
All right, John?
I give it an 8.
I give it an 8 as well.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. Pretty unanimous. We all like this one.
Yeah, this is a good solid record. And it was also produced by Matt Wallace, who also produced Angel Dust in 1992. So it was kind of a wait there. 3 years?
Yeah, it was. It was a big deal when Angel Dust came out and pissed off a lot of the casual fans.
Oh, I'm sure.
Believe me, the reaction was really bad. I was like, wow, when I listened to it, because I go by the CD. It was the first Faith No More CD I bought, I think, brand new, and I went and listened to it. I just thought it was amazing, and then but all my friends hated it.
It's so different from those first few albums. It is just a complete departure.
It's just Faith No More being metal. That's all. It was their attempt at being metal. That's all it was.
Metal, but
I didn't even think it was metal.
It's totally avant-garde.
Yeah.
I mean, the songs are so – there are so many different directions it goes in. It's crazy. Like, you have, like, them covering Midnight Cowboy. There's, like, almost borderline death metal with Jizz Lobber.
Yeah.
Which was written – that and Kindergarten were the only songs Jim Martin worked on. His involvement in the band was kind of diminishing at this point. Like, he was barely around for the writing, and but he was there for most of the recording, but there were a lot of rumors that Billy Gould played a lot of the guitar on the record, but...
We should note as well Jim Martin's appearance in the Bill and Ted Excellent Adventure.
I haven't watched that movie in years.
In Bogus Street. Sir Jim Martin from the Church of Faith No More.
Yeah.
But, his role in the band was kind of diminishing at this point. This was his last record with them. But Billy Gould set the record straight in a – I think it was a recent interview. He said that he did play a little bit of guitar, but Jim was there for most of the recording. But, yes, the singles on this one were Land of Sunshine, I think, Midlife Crisis, Small Victory, and Everything's Ruined.
Didn't they do a 45 of Easy as well?
Yes.
Be Aggressive on the flip side of it, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, Easy was not on the CD, and I don't know if it was on the cassette. It was almost like a one-off single that came out later.
Yeah. If you go download it on the internet, it's on there, but yeah. It was
on the Australian pressing.
It might have been, but it was not on the CD. It says on re-release only on Wikipedia, so I'm going to take that.
On the Australian, but the Australian release had, as it says there, the four-track live thing, and also the bonus songs there. Because I remember seeing Easy on there thinking, oh, I know this song. I've heard it somewhere along the way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so.
Yeah, they had no hits off this, from what I remember. It just, like. It was very rejected.
What a surprise.
Was it Jim Martin said that, you know, they had this massive hit record with The Real Thing, and when they were recording this record at the studio, their manager or somebody or someone from the record label was in there listening, and he goes, well, I hope nobody bought a new house.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Jim Martin said he was kind of pissed because it was sucking the energy out of the room because the people were just like, well, they were hearing it. But, I mean, it has some really catchy songs. Like, Midlife Crisis is a really catchy tune.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think Everything's Ruins really catchy as well. Small Victory, you know, but the album's so strange. It's so different from the last one that, of course, I could see how it would alienate fans.
It did. Well, but to me, it was kind of like their Paul's Boutique.
Yeah.
Paul's Boutique hated when it was released.
Yeah.
Nobody bought it.
Now it's considered this classic record like this one.
And,
you know?
Well, I had a friend push, coincidentally, the same friend that had the vinyl of Faith No More with Mosley, he pushed the cassette of Paul's Boutique on me and said, you got to listen to it, because all their fans hated it. And so I listened to it and thought it was the most amazing album I'd ever heard.
Yeah.
And to me, Angel Dust is kind of like that. It's like, if you were a real music fan and burnt out by what you were hearing on the radio at the time, which was it was Pearl Jam, I think, and Nirvana, and all that stuff had gotten huge. The Chili Peppers got big. And none of it I was really crazy about. And so when I heard this album, I loved it because I could tell they were mixing in all this funk stuff and kind of different sounding metal than what we considered metal at the time.
Right.
And I mean, like, the song RV is like a Tom Waits song. It's done like a Tom Waits track. And I thought it was hilarious. But I think people expecting another real thing were just like, oh, what's this shit? You know, they don't like the experimental thing about them, you know?
No, and Patton's vocal style changed considerably, too.
Yeah.
Like, in the last album, he's, you know, a little more R&B, a little more funk. He's got kind of a high-pitched sort of thing he's doing. And this one, he's all over the place. Like, you know, he's doing the deep vocals, the kind of growly death metal vocals. He's doing the operatic vocals. You know, it's
the R&B vocals come in some tracks where you don't expect them, like Crack Hitler.
Yeah, Crack Hitler for sure.
Yeah, it's like you don't expect it in that song because it has this crushing like speed metal sound to it at first, and then it has these R&B like you know, kind of riffs and stuff. It just kind of goes all over the place. And needless to say, the album was really alienating when it came out.
I mean, now it's considered to be this, like, great, influential record, you know?
Yeah.
But it's kind of funny how that's the case with a lot of these albums that are considered so great and influential, like Paul's Boutique, like this, where it just,
right,
it's totally flatlines when it first comes out and has to grow that audience later.
Well, it's like, it influenced a lot of people. Like, the people who bought it were inspired by it, just like Paul's Boutique inspired Public Enemy's Fear of a Black Planet.
Right.
Like, Chuck D admitted that. He goes, we were trying to do a Paul's Boutique because they'd upped the game and we had to top it. So I think when this album came out, like, musicians bought it and was like, okay, I got to try to top this.
And, yeah, like, a lot of prog metal bands love to cover Malpractice.
You know, right.
You know, which is one of the stranger tracks on there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. So what did you think of this one, Stu?
I just didn't like it. It was just there. No, there was not one standout track. I thought, gee, I really enjoyed that. It felt like one big long song for about 45 minutes, whatever it runs for. Just,
really?
I didn't like it at all. Yeah, I didn't like this one whatsoever.
That's interesting.
I'd probably say it's not the worst of them. I think that's still to come yet. Don't get me wrong.
I agree.
Yeah. No, I thought it was just – it felt like a metal parody to me, actually.
Really?
Yeah. I just – you know, if you're going to play metal – don't be like a Steel Panther. But like, Grant, Steel Panther is a completely different type
of
rock.
Really overt, you know?
Oh, of course. But, I mean, this felt like Faith No More saying, nah, okay, let's go in a different direction. I'm all for that, you know? But just trying to do a metal album and not sound like metal at all, sound like pseudo-metal, nah, I don't like it. I don't think the songwriting's there. There's no... It just flatlines along the whole way. I don't like it. No.
I could see where you're talking about where it, like, because the album has a sense of humor. But I actually
really
think it's kind
I don't
of
I don't think so.
Funny.
Yeah, I don't particularly think it's funny at all. I just think it's just stupid.
Well, it's like the problem is a lot of the lyrics come from like hidden things that most people just don't know about. It's like a lot of it's in jokes. Like Be Aggressive is actually based on one of the band members went to some sort of retreat with the singer of the Cult, Ian Astbury, where they all went out into the desert and acted like Indians. A lot of the lyrics come from the stuff they were. It was like an Iron John type thing.
Well, I had heard that because the song was written by Roddy Bottom. Be Aggressive was, and the song's about sucking cock. Like,
right.
You know, and Mike Patton said Roddy thought it would be hilarious to have him, a straight dude, sing a song about taking loads in the mouth. You know?
Yeah.
So I had heard it was like a clown on Patton. I didn't know that story.
But it's like there's a chant going in there, like you'll do what I say or something. It was similar to what they were doing at the weird tribe retreat thing.
Take it on your knees or something.
Like, yeah, it was like some from different things. You know, it's like a lot of stuff where it comes from different influences. Yeah, it's about sucking cock, but
like, and there's little things like Midlife Crisis is about Madonna.
Right.
I'd heard that.
Which, boy, that's still relevant today. But yeah. Another thing is, it's like how David Lee Roth was talking about his songwriting process, that he'll hear a line in an old movie and just say, okay, I'm going to use that. And then he'll take something else from a different set, throw it in.
But the thing is, John, with that, David Lee Roth is actually, when he's funny about a lyric, you get it. You get what Dave's saying.
A lot of people didn't at the time, though, Stu. A lot of people thought Dave was being serious. Which is why they were often misunderstood at the time.
I still love David Lee Roth.
When you look at these negative comments about him on YouTube, this clown, you know, and it's like, no, that's the point. You know, he's trying to be like a Dean Martin of rock and roll. It's the idea. He can laugh at himself, you know.
Yeah, that's right. But with Faith No More's, you know, lyrics or, you know, the comedy in their lyrics, I didn't hear it at all. Unlike Dave's stuff, you know, but that's two completely different entities right there.
Well,
right. But no, I just didn't like it.
All right, so John, what do you give this album?
I give it a 9.
9?
Still impresses me years later, and sometimes with these albums, I'll hate them 5 or 6 years later, and this holds up really well for me.
So, Stu?
Probably at 2.5, I'd say.
No. I'm going to give this is another 10 for me. I think this is the definitive Faith No More album.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I mean, I think this is their definitive crowning work.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so the next album, King for a Day, Fool for a Lifetime, 1995.
Would you guys say this is about the most obscure Faith No More album, apart from We Care a Lot?
No.
No? Okay, because to me it was
that's
just
the fan. Angel Dust is probably the fan favorite.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I knew a lot of fans liked it. That's why I was anticipating it when I heard it. I was like, ugh. But
it might grow on you, but I don't know if you'll even bother to listen to it again. But
I will bring this up later. I'm not done yet. But
okay.
I'll make a statement later.
Well, I'll put it this way. It's one of those albums that may sound abrasive the first time you hear it or first couple of times you hear it. And then when you listen to it later, it sounds amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But if you get your prejudice out of the way when you first hear it, because it can be. I think when I first heard it, I didn't quite know what I was hearing.
Yeah,
I was like, God, this is all over the place.
It's such a strange album. Yeah,
but then I listened to it like 3 or 4 times over the next few days, and I was like, okay, it's growing on me. I get it now.
Yeah,
It's not another Epic. Okay, I accept it. You know, and then I ended up liking it more than Epic.
Well, so the next album is King for a Day, Fool for a Lifetime. Which was released in 1995. Jim Martin has left the band. Apparently, he just stopped showing up for practice. And Trey Spruance.
That's a cool way to say you're not coming back.
Yeah, I heard he just stopped showing up for practice. He just lost interest. And actually, well, real quick, I'll say Jim Martin went on to be a champion pumpkin grower. True story.
Really?
Yeah.
Imagine the little market you could hold with him with the pumpkins and the singer from Tool with his wine collection and his vineyard.
And Cherry Curry with her chainsaw.
Oh, God, but she's just insane, though. That's all. She's still scornful when she got raped by Kim Fowley. That's all.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that's another story.
Yeah, that's another story.
Discussion for another time.
But he did put out one solo record, Blood and Milk. And it actually had James Hetfield doing backing vocals on it. But he's done some appearances here and there, but he was pretty much retired from music until recently. He has been doing live dates with Infectious Grooves on guitar.
Well, he was that little band he had in the 90s where it was Jim Martin, Socrates, Plato.
What? Oh, yes, yes. There was that.
Oh, and Bill and Ted. Yeah, Wild Stallions, that was it.
Wild Stallions, yeah, it's great.
That's the one.
No, but yeah, apart from, you know, changing the world with their rock and roll, Jim Martin was mostly retired, but he started playing with Infectious Grooves, And actually, he shared a bill with Mike Patton's band Tomahawk at Metallica's Orion Fest. So apparently they had a little reunion there. Not live, but apparently they spoken for the first time in a while. But
text message.
Yeah.
10 feet away from each other, probably.
But so you know, he's been doing stuff. Apparently he was invited to their reunion, or maybe not. I can't remember. But so Trace Bruance was replaced him on this record, and he plays in Mr. Bungle, Mike Patton's side project, which got signed after the success of Faith No More, which if you think Angel Dust is weird, Mr. Bungle is really
I've heard
weird.
About yeah, I don't even want to venture into that.
The only Mr. Bungle record that I think is accessible, most, and that's using the word very loosely, is California. But
all right.
Which is a good one. But so King for a Day, Fool for a Lifetime, major singles were Digging a Grave, Ricochet, yeah, and Evidence.
Digging the Grave is one I remember the most, yeah, for sure. It was played on radio a lot through here.
Yeah,
like in the alternative stations, yeah.
What'd you think of your first listening?
It was all right. It was better than Angel Dust, but then again, anything's better than Angel Dust, really. Obviously, for Digging the Grave, which I really did like I said, yeah, it started off strong, and it just sort of wavered again, and I think it had too many songs on it for a start. 14 songs was
it is
way
quite
too
a
much.
Much longer record.
Yeah.
It's kind of all over the place in terms of genres. You kind of have this like George Jonesy type song with Take This Bottle. You got this like bizarre like proto Dillinger Escape Plan music with Cuckoo for Caca and Gentle Art of Making Enemies. Evidence is kind of smooth jazzy, you know. And
do you know what Cuckoo for Caca is?
Cuckoo for Shit.
Yeah, crazy for shit.
And they say in the song "Shit Lives Forever" or whatever.
Yeah.
Mike Patton had a reputation for shit terrorism, he called it, on the road, like terrorizing people with poop.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
He should call himself Mr. Bunghole, I guess.
Mr. Bunghole, yeah.
It was probably an intention at one point.
you kind of
a bit like that singer from Sugar Ray. He's got a fetish for getting women to piss in his mouth.
Yeah.
Does he?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow. Jeez.
Yeah.
Wow.
He's very big on the Golden Showers. I've forgotten the guy's name.
Mark McGrath.
Okay. That's him. Yeah. Yeah. He's very well known among the P community.
Nice. So what'd you think of this, John?
It's uneven. I remember buying it like the day it came out and not really being too impressed with it.
It's
like it starts off good, like Stu said, and then it just kind of it gets real hit or miss for me. It's like Get Out is like the best track on the album for me, and then the rest of it's just kind of just it feels like Mr. Bungle leftovers or something.
Well, yeah, I mean we got like a good chunk of Mr. Bungle in the band,
right? And it just and I didn't really I've never been able to get into it that much.
Like,
there's not a lot.
I know Jim
stuff.
Martin wasn't really heavily involved with Angel Dust, but I think he's really missing from this record.
Yeah, there's I think his influence is gone, and I mean there's very little you could even say was metal, and that's neither I'm neither here nor there on that, but I think for their sound it helped to have Martin around.
Like I mean, and I really like the song Evidence. Mm-hmm. I think Mike Patton's vocal range is great on that song. He's really like moving across it. I like some of the heavier songs, Dig in the Grave, Get Out, Cuckoo for Caca with Mike Patton just doing crazy shit. But, you know, it does feel uneven. You know, I mean, I don't dislike the record, but what do you think of Take This Bottle, John?
It was funny. I got the joke when I first heard it.
It's I was really wondering what you thought of that song specifically because it is so George Jonesy. And even when George Jones died, I remember Mike Patton posting a lot about him on his Facebook page.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, you know, he was posting like George Jones songs he liked and stuff. It's. I think we're kind of treading again into fans-only territory.
Yeah.
And it also, there were some bonus tracks that were out there, like Absolute Zero, which I've heard, and that's a that's actually heavier than I think anything else on there. And they also did a cover of the Bee Gees' I Started a Joke.
That I want to hear. I really want to hear that one.
Actually, and they gave it, they put it on their, when they broke up, they put it on their Greatest Hits record.
Oh, really?
Yeah, as a farewell. Yeah.
Okay.
And they did a music video for it and everything.
Yeah.
So if you look it up on YouTube, you can find it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very straight cover. But I don't really have too much to say about it. Do you remember anything about the critical reception for this, John, or what people thought of it?
It was kind of ignored. They were considered a has-been group by then.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just kind of like, you know, it would get the 2.5-star ratings in the Rolling Stones and that sort of magazine.
Right.
It wasn't really praised. It wasn't really – it didn't sell from what I remember. It didn't – it was actually the first Faith No More CD that I noticed in what we would call the $7.99 bin, whereas they wouldn't be cutouts, but they would be cheap.
Right.
You know, a lot of Warner Brothers stuff was like that, and it was like in there pretty quick.
I mean, I think the album has a – this was their first one without Matt Wallace.
Right.
But I think the album has a – I think it has a consistent sound, and I do like – I do like the record, but it's just as though it's not as its experimentation isn't as interesting.
It was a band on its way out, I thought.
Right. Well,
they were done. It was like when the Black Oak Arkansas's manager told the record label, "This band is done."
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like that's the feeling I got listening to this. Like, I think when I bought it that day, I was like, "This band is done."
So we're gonna try and incorporate Black Oak Arkansas into every episode in Rock Month. I think
we need to.
Yeah,
that's a new thing. If we can't. You can't talk about kung fu films when you're talking about this stuff, so we're going to have to bring in Black Oak Arkansas. Speaking
you know what, Black Oak Arkansas?
Or Ted Nugent.
Ted Nugent. Yeah, he's starting to piss me off lately. Don't worry about
he's
Ted
He's got
Nugent.
A new record coming. Speaking of Black Oak Arkansas, when I was in Memphis this weekend, one of my my friend's girlfriend said she saw Jim Dandy at the grocery store the other day. and there's a little place called the Young Avenue Deli, and they're going to play there with Black Flag pretty soon. So
Jesus.
Oh, that's gonna be great. Well, you know, I don't know if I said this on the last show, but when I saw Jim Dandy at that biker bar after they were done, I remember you had mentioned Jim Dandy being with hookers. Jim Dandy had yelled out after they finally played the encore 2.5 hours later, he went, "I wish one of y'all would find me a woman tonight."
Go over to fucking Elvis Presley Boulevard. You can find one real quick.
Oh, no.
Well, I figured somebody was going to have to take him over to Glendale or something. Down Colfax.
Real quick, though, one thought I did have about this album was that Roddy Bottom conspicuously absent from most of the songs. Like, you have a lot of piano and keyboards on Evidence. A little bit here and there, but a lot of the record's fairly keyboardless, I thought. It felt like he wasn't really – he doesn't have a lot of – he's barely credited on the record. It just it seemed like he wasn't really there.
Well, because it's pretty much Mr. Bungle doing a Faith No More album.
Right. Which Trace Bruance actually didn't tour with the record. A guy named Dean Minta did, who was their guitar tech. Yeah, Spruance decided he just didn't want to tour with the band.
A bit like Metallica when James Hetfield was breaking his arm every 2 days.
I know.
And they have John Marshall there, the guitar already playing. He was actually about 3,000 times better than Hetfield as a guitarist.
Oh, man. Speaking of thrash metal, Stu, I when I saw that Rob Dukes left Exodus, I was like, oh, Stu's going to be so excited.
Oh, yes,
Zetro's back.
Zetro's back. Yeah. I can't friggin' wait for
that. I was like, Stu's doing the toxic waltz over in Australia right now.
Yeah.
All right, so ratings for
if King. If only I had a friend to kick in the head, I'd be even better.
No, too bad I'm
if
not
only
there.
I had a friend, I suppose. My life would be complete, I guess.
So ratings for King for a Day, Fool for a Lifetime. Stu?
I give it, say, 5. It was okay.
5. All right.
Eh.
John?
5.
5. I'll give it a 6.
Okay.
I think I like it just a little bit more. So, 2 years later, the band replaces Dean Minta tours. They replace him with John Hudson. who was a roommate of Billy Gould, and they went and recorded Album of the Year, which...
Was this one a contractual obligation?
The album title I heard was a joke, like, because they weren't really happy with it, you know?
And okay. It sounds like Coda.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
It's definitely got the Coda vibe. It's got the contractual obligation vibe.
And this album, like John and I were talking, this album was a total dud. Like, the singles on it were Ashes to Ashes, Last Cup of Sorrow, and Strip Search. And they were going to do a video for She Loves Me Not, but I think the album was doing so bad they didn't want to spend the money on it. So
it got bad reviews. It was just, like, dumped.
Rolling Stone gave it, like, a 1 star.
Yeah, it got really bad reviews at the time and did not sell. I did not hear it until today.
And for Last Cup of Sorrow, like, they did some expensive-looking videos for this. Like, the video for Ashes to Ashes is very produced. And then Last Cup of Sorrow is a it does a, like, a kind of sort of tongue-in-cheek take on Vertigo, and it has Jennifer Jason Leigh in it.
Mm.
And it's quite a, you know, and it even has, like the little freak-out scene where Jimmy Stewart's floating head with the colors. And in Vertigo, you have Mike Patton's floating head, and you see Mike Borden doing his hair with a giant brush. But so what'd you think of this album, Stu?
I really like it a lot, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Really?
A lot, yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay, John.
It's probably powered by the fact I think Ashes to Ashes is the best song they've ever done.
I like the singles.
Fucking amazing.
I like the singles on this album a lot. I like Strip Church. I love Last Cup of Sorrow. But Ashes to Ashes, that's one of my favorite Faith No More tunes.
Same, I like Collision as well. I think
it's a great opener.
Yeah, very much.
What'd you think?
There's a couple of dud tracks in there, but not a lot.
Really? I think the album starts to sort of peter out after Ashes to Ashes. Like She Loves Me Not, Got That Feeling's All Right. Paths of Glory, Homesick Home, and Pristina. I just listened to the album again today, and I couldn't tell you what those songs sound like. You know?
I thought Pristina was a bad way to finish it off.
Right.
Yeah.
But I do like if we're talking in terms of vinyl, I like the first side. I like Ashes to Ashes on the second side, and then I think it kind of just fizzles.
But for me, compared to the last two duds, well, I wouldn't say King for a Day was a dud. It was just okay. It was there compared to that disaster, Angel Dust. This is a quantum leap forward for me anyway.
Right. John, this was your first time hearing it. What do you think?
It's pretty unmemorable. So I think Ashes to Ashes is the only song I'd actually heard before.
Right.
And whichever one was on their greatest hits comp, because I think
their greatest hits comp... Everyone I've heard includes Ashes to Ashes, Last Cup of Sorrow, Strip Search.
So I've heard those, but the album, one listen, nothing made an impression. That's not to say I wouldn't have liked it when it came out, but in the years since this was released, like, my listening is all over the place. Always has been, actually, and I don't think I would be, you know, nowadays it's hard for me to be impressed by anything, and I'm just like, it doesn't really do anything for me.
He's a cynical old fucker, this guy.
Yeah, well, you got to remember my taste is different from the other two. To the listeners out there, I can't stand Metallica. Like, I absolutely, they bore the hell out of me. They're like,
really? Even to me,
they are the audio version of watching paint dry. I've seen them live. I saw them on the For Justice for All tour, or whatever the hell it was called, and they just bored the hell out of me.
Actually, you know what's funny is
I never understood them.
Metallica even said that when they were doing the And Justice for All tour, they were playing the new songs, and they realized their new songs were way too long because they could see the audience getting bored.
Oh, man. I saw them on the Justice tour back in 89 or 90, whenever they hit Melbourne, and, man, you never saw a more bored-looking audience when those songs are on. Right. Like, they play.
I mean, I love the first three Metallica records. I think those are classic records.
The most bored I've ever seen people at a concert was Ronnie James Dio.
Yeah,
it really was. I saw, like, Dio was belting out shit like, you know, Sunset Superman and stuff, and people, like, we were just talking to each other. No one was even watching Dio. We were that bored by it. And with Metallica, yeah, I told you, I've still got that live recording on tape. I do have it. And boy, it drags you right down. It's just that boring. Listen to it.
No, I only went to see them because The Cult was opening, and The Cult was way more fun. And the Colts, even though Ian awesome. Asbury weighed like 300 pounds because he just came off of heroin, so he was like all fat on the stage. But they were awesome, and they brought out Steve Jones, and they played like a rock gig and then or a set. And then Metallica comes out, and it's just like, this is for guys with pimples and long hair and who want to sit up there. At that time, banging your head looked dumb to me because we didn't have MTV in my town. So it's just like I wasn't following what all the hoods were doing, and I was just like, I just wrote them off. I couldn't stand them. And the stuff I heard later just never did anything for me. I heard the early stuff. It's better to a certain extent, but I know it doesn't do anything for me.
Oh, man, like Ride the Lightning and shit. I've been actually collecting the ultimate editions of those albums because there's been so many pressings of Metallica stuff over the years. I've actually sought out an audiophile site, stevehoffman.com, I think it's called. It's an audiophile site. And tracking down the original version of the Megaforce Records CD version of Kill 'Em All, because that's by far the best one, and the 24-karat gold disc of Ride the Lightning and Master of Puppets. I've actually got them, and man, they sound freaking good compared to the abominations that Electric put out. Shame on you, Electra.
It's funny because I love Motorhead, and I like Slayer, and I like the Misfits, and...
See, I can't really get into Slayer. Slayer just never did it for me.
I'm more of a Slayer guy. Like I listen to Rain and Blood, and to me, that's what Metallica was supposed to sound like. And some people can't stand Slayer because it's too much of the punk influence.
The only Slayer I'll take is Hell Awaits and South of Heaven. After that, Show No Mercy, I don't mind. It's very metal. Apart from that, I'm not interested.
Show No Mercy is very Venom sounding.
Yeah.
But I love Slayer with the Rain and Blood sound. I got that on vinyl. I love it. It's great.
Metallica is I've banished to the island of bands like U2 and Pearl Jam. I'll just never get it. REM would be another. Just don't understand. I don't get it. And it just, you know. It's a dog whistle act to me.
Jesus Christ.
Well, I like about half of this album, but it does sound like the band's tired at times. And, you know, this album, it didn't do well, but it did actually sell well in Australia, funnily enough, from what
I think they always did. I think they were very popular over here, Faith No More. They were touring every so often. But at the time, like I said, I wasn't into them. I'd only heard, you know, sparse tracks all over the place, you know. But never got into their catalog until what, the last 7 days or so. Listen to their catalog, I should say.
This was their last album. They broke up not too long after, and I think just the commercial failure of this, and coupled with, I think they were just kind of done.
Because
all of them went off to go do other projects. Mike Borden played drums for Ozzy for a long time. Like, if you watch the documentary God Bless Ozzy Osbourne, he's all over that one because he was playing with Ozzy at the time. Billy Gould plays in Jello Biafra's band, the Guantanamo School of Medicine.
No, I guess what they sing about.
Yeah.
Corporations!
But yeah. But Billy Gould also has a record label, and he does a lot of other projects. And then,
Corporation Sock, here's the Alternative Tentacles catalog.
Yes. I will not cut in the other members of Dead Kennedys on any of it.
No royalties for East Bay Ray.
D.H. Pellegro. No.
Go get a real job.
I know.
Klaus Fluoride sounds like a German toothpaste.
And then, what was it, Roddy Bottom went and started a band called Imperial Teen, which is kind of his primary gig now. And Mike Patton's done a million things alongside everything else. Phantomas did an album with Dan the Automator called Nathaniel Merriweather's Music to Make Love to Your Old Lady By. He did this album called Peeping Tom, which was the first album where I went, okay, don't buy everything Mike Patton does.
Yeah.
And but he's been on countless it made so many appearances. He's also did the soundtracks for Crank 2.
Yeah.
And Place Beyond the Pines. He does a lot of voice work. He played all the voices of all the vampire creatures in I Am Legend. with Will Smith.
His best thing that he did, two great things in his solo career that I respect him greatly for. And one was he released a compilation of Ennio Morricone's music for giallo films.
Yeah.
That is great. And he also did a tribute to the Italian pop songs you hear in those films with the Mondo Cane CD, which I think
have that
like
one. That's
thing.
A great.
Record. I thought it was incredible, and that's probably the best thing he's done outside of that.
And he did a live show in Chile recently with Ennio Morricone.
Yeah, I got to get an audio or video of that.
Yeah, they. I don't think they played together, but I think they played on the same bill or something.
Interesting. You know what? But yeah, he's a real booster of that music.
Mm-hmm. He's fluent Italian. Yeah,
I'll give Faith No More this for the Who Cares a Lot greatest hits they released the next year in '98. Probably the only band ever to stick Benny Hill on the front cover.
Yes.
For a young Benny Hill. That shows a sense of humor. Mm-hmm. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, they they came along at a weird time where those listening to metal and listening to rap, it was two separate groups. Because I remember being at a party in California where the older rock fans that were bitching about Faith No More, like they hated them because they were bringing like the rap thing into hard rock or metal. And I remember trying to get a local station to play one of their songs, and the guy answered the phone was like, "Nah, man, that's more of the rap thing. We don't really play that stuff.
They're too rock for rap, and they're too rap for rock, man."
Yeah, and at that time, like metal was boring, and a lot of metal fans were listening to stuff like Ice-T and Public Enemy because it was more aggressive and exciting than, you know, what you were getting from the metal scene at the time, which was still in the Poison ballads and
right,
White Lion and that sort of crap.
Trickster.
Yeah, people forget what a weird thing it was when Faith No More came out. It was just like, because it was still White Lion and just all this other terrible stuff.
Yeah, like when you look at Faith No More, you go, okay, that's a weird band. But when you look at them in the context of what was out there, they seem even more like strange.
Right. It's just like, but I remember like when I heard Epic, and I was just like, God, this sounds so much better than everything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was just one of those moments. And that, like I said, that's what MTV was still playing, you know, Trickster and all that shit.
Striper.
Yeah. Just Striper and just like guys who are supposed to be playing heavy music are singing ballads to girls,
Britney
about
Fox.
How much they love them. Like Bryan Adams type stuff, you know? Yeah, Britney Fox.
As Kim Thales said, they sounded like the Partridge Family with fuzzy guitars.
Yeah, exactly. It was just, that's what that music said. Like, I listen to some of these younger metalheads I meet are acting like Nirvana killed everything. Bullshit. It's like, that stuff was so, metal was so bad before Nirvana broke through. It was unreal. Like, people just forget.
As Kim Thayil said, I place a jihad on all of them.
I think he said that while he was shaking his finger in the air.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure of it.
Yeah.
he was sending messages to Bergadol.
Yes, he's... Actually, I think he was sending messages to the five escaped prisoners, or the five released prisoners.
Durka, Jihad, Durka, Durka.
We should actually give a plug to our friends over at Super Mexican. They've just done an epic, God, about three episodes on Bergdahl, and you need to hear Bill just go berserk about it. It's crazy. He's just sitting there going, how the fuck did we transfer five prisoners for one guy? One defector or something, and just... Yeah, I was talking to Bill last night on Twitter. He goes, I can go far enough.
Yeah. It is one of those so illogical things that you just wonder, I can't even make a joke about it. It's just too surreal.
It sounds like something from a conspiracy like thriller, like a Tom Clancy novel.
If you did this in a Tom Clancy novel, they'd say it was far-fetched.
Yes.
No, they never do that. Come on.
Sounds like a Jack Ryan's plot or something.
Well, Bill hit me up about actually possibly coming back on and doing an episode of Wag the Dog so we can incorporate Bergdahl into it. I said, I don't mind.
Yeah, let's do Wag the Dog. Sure. Nobody else is talking about it.
No.
Yeah.
And everybody hates David Mamet now because he's right wing.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, suddenly he's the worst playwright ever.
Oh, he's like, oh. I saw, like, what was it? I saw Brian Koppelman does these, like, 6-second screenwriting, like, motivational things on Vine. And he quoted David Mamet on one of them, and all the comments were like, was this before he became crazy and right-wingy? And it became terrible.
Oh, no.
Yeah, because suddenly he's just going to lose all his talent.
Yeah, all of a sudden, nothing he writes is worth anything.
Yeah.
Well, did we rate Album of the Year?
Oh, no, we didn't. Okay.
What would you give Album of the Year, Stu?
Probably, I'd say about a solid 7.
7? John?
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's like a 3 or 4, just unmemorable. Not saying I won't listen to it again and it'll grow on me, but just on first listen, it just didn't do anything for me.
I give it a 6. I think the singles on it are really strong.
Yeah. But
the album as a whole just doesn't, it just kind of fizzles out, and it does feel like a band that's just not interested anymore. Like, they had a few good ideas that they really executed really well, but it, you know, it really, like, I listened to my vinyl copy today, and it really just kind of fizzled out at the end. The first side, I was really into it, and then it just kind of petered down after Ashes to Ashes.
Mm-hmm. It was a band that's finished.
Yeah. But, so we talked about a little bit about what they've been doing since they broke up, but they got back together in 2009, I think.
Word gone around these to new album in the works as well.
That's the rumor. They did some reunion shows, and they said they were going to do a new record. They did like the Second Coming tour, and there's lots of video on the internet from that tour. And they said they're going to do.
Did we see Jim Martin in any of these reunions?
No, he apparently was invited to one of them.
Right.
But he didn't show up. But they did get Chuck Mosley at one of the shows. And he did We Care A Lot, I think. And he and Mike Patton did Introduce Yourself together.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, they did the song. Oh. They did like a double header. They duetted the song. But they said they were going to do an album. Then Mike Patton was saying it wasn't happening. Billy Gould was saying it's going to happen someday. But just recently, in the past week or so, Faith No More joined Twitter. They opened their official Twitter account, and the first tweet said, this reunion thing has been cool, but it's time to get more creative, and it had a picture of Mike Patton, like, kind of making a face into the camera. And their tweets have been kind of, you know, cryptic, just like picture, like close-up pictures of the band, pictures of things, but now everybody's thinking that, okay, Faith No More is finally working on a new record.
I think the thing that's stopping them, though, is the anticipation to be so high.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing.
After nearly 20 years of the last studio album.
Because,
I mean, it would be just fever pitch by the time, okay, they're saying we'll release an album. The pressure would be immense.
Because this is a band that, like, let's face it, like, its fans today mostly come after they broke up, you know?
Yeah.
They built a fan base based on their legacy, and, you know, so if they put out that new record, it's a big risk, you know?
I'll be honest, I didn't know they had a legacy. I honestly thought they were forgotten.
I've read a lot of stuff. Nah. I read a lot of stuff online and a lot of people talking about them. And, you know, the Second Coming tour, you look at those crowds and they're really big.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's kind of tough. It's kind of tough when you have that legacy you built up since you broke up. You know, doing the reunion shows is obviously awesome, but when you're doing new stuff, So, yeah. I don't know. I'm excited, but I am kind of trepidatious about them, you know, sticking their dick in their legacy, but we'll see. I hope they make the album, and it's great, you know.
All right. Well, I will say this, okay? I place every review on these albums with a caveat, because I've only heard them once, bar The Real Thing, which I've heard a couple of times now, I'd say, two or three times. So I will revisit them all. Probably save for Angel Dust. I'm not in the mood for that one.
You should give that one another shot, because that is one that really grows with repeat listens, I think.
All right, I will do that, but it won't be first on the revisit
list.
Like stuff like We Care A Lot, I'll listen to again, because I want to try and get into it.
Especially because you like Chuck.
Yeah, very much.
Yeah.
You know, I prefer his vocal style, but that's me. Introduce Yourself won't be a problem. Listen to again. Real Thing won't be a problem. Same with Album of the Year, won't be a problem for me. Just the ones I'm not flash on at the moment, I will definitely revisit, because I don't think, from my perspective, Faith No More don't seem the sort of band you can instantly get straight away. Right. They're not like the Ramones.
Right.
You know, they're not like the Ramones where there's nothing hidden about the Ramones. It's
you get the Ramones or Motorhead, right away.
You know? What you hear is what you get. You know, there's nothing deep rooted in that in the song that you're missing the first time around. So yeah, I place every review on these albums with a caveat.
Yeah, a little asterisk.
Yeah, same
yeah.
shit.
Yeah,
But I mean, I can't say I hated doing this. You know, revisiting these albums for the first time. I was actually anticipating it. Some struck me, some didn't. But you know, that's the gamble you take when you listen to a new group.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, it's true. I don't know. I got into Faith No More way after they broke up, and they quickly became one of my favorite bands. Just, you know, I download soundboard recordings. You know, I try to find everything I can, you know.
Yeah.
And check it out. Because, you know, like I have a soundboard recording where they open the show with Woodpecker from Mars, but then it goes into Delilah. You know, and Mike Patton doing this operatic rendition of like My Delilah, you know.
Well, it's just like he would start singing Technotronics, Pump Up the Jam, and
oh yeah,
New Kids on the Block in the middle of a song. Just
they even did like the Nestle commercial jingle.
Yeah, just always he always did stuff
and,
like that.
The Cranberry Zombie. And was it a lot of times live when they play Chinese Arithmetic. During the little interlude at the beginning where it's just kind of bass and keyboards, Mike Patton will all usually do a rendition of a current hit single. Like, I've seen one video where he kind of scats Poker Face by Lady Gaga, but does a lot of DJ scratches with his voice.
Right.
Or Lily Allen's Fuck You, you know, just like little bits. But, so it's just kind of something he likes to do during that song whenever they play it.
Yeah, it's interesting for me because I was kind of there at Ground Zero when they broke in with Epic, and then it's just a band I kind of just gave up on.
Mm.
Like, was amazed when Angel Dust was released, and then a couple of years later just did not care anything about them.
Yeah.
It's really strange because now listening to this stuff today was, you know, in many times – this is actually the first time I've listened to them in a long time, and I was just like – oh, I forgot how much I really liked these guys back in the early 90s.
Yeah.
And then just kind of gave up on them and just quit listening. It wasn't like the Ramones where I'm consistently listening to them or, you know, certain reggae groups or rap groups or James Brown or whatever. It's just like I really haven't gone back and listened to these guys in forever. Like, loved them and then just forgot about them.
Mm-hmm.
It's strange.
Seems like a flash in the pan, but most of it held up for you. The stuff you ended up, you remember.
Yeah, liking. What I liked, I still liked. What kind of you know, bored me or I was lukewarm to them, it's still the same way.
Mm.
And with Album of the Year, I can just see why they broke up. And
yeah.
And I was wondering, maybe it's because Mike Patton is spread too thin. Maybe it's because these guys did too many side projects.
And I had heard that Mike Patton was never. He never considered Faith No More to be his top priority.
Right.
Like, Mr. Bungle was his band. He always considered Faith No More to be someone else's band.
That was his, like, his bill payer.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, he was like, he said Faith No More taught him the music industry.
Yeah.
And now he has his own record label. You know, like, the Melvins are on his label now, Epicac Records.
Right, right.
He said he learned the music biz from Faith No More. But it was playing in someone else's band, and he would often, like, I think Hawk, he would hawk Mr. Bungle demo tapes at Faith No More shows. You know? Mm-hmm. And you can even see in the Epic video, he's wearing a Mr. Bungle t-shirt.
Yeah, it was, I mean,
oh yeah,
he always felt, he seemed like a hired gun the whole time.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's how he saw it.
Well, I mean, you know, and he did great work with them, but he, you know, his passions lie elsewhere, not necessarily with Faith No More, but who knows? I mean, maybe we'll see. Maybe he'll. I can't imagine. I always figured a Faith No More album, a new one not happening, was because he wasn't interested, you know? Mm-hmm. But who knows? Maybe he is now. We'll see. So that's Faith No More, one of my favorite bands. They were my pick for Rock Month. And I really enjoyed listening to. I listen to all their records pretty regularly, but I enjoyed listening to like all of them, just like going through the gauntlet and checking them all out again. But yeah. Oh, and one thing I wanted to talk about real quick, to follow up on something last week. We were talking about why bands don't make albums as frequently as they used to.
Yeah.
And John was saying I didn't think the talent's there, and we were thinking I was thinking about it, and there's something that's really changed in the music business is that albums don't bring in the money they used to.
No, they don't.
So I kind of wonder if maybe there's just no incentive.
Could be.
Bands could get the money if they went about it the right way.
Well, now there's like crowdfunding and stuff, so we're kind of seeing something change with that maybe. But
you can actually eliminate record labels.
Yeah,
you don't need
of course.
Them. These days, you don't need record labels. You can do it all on your own. You can, if you've got your own website, you can set it up and say, right, we've got a new album coming out. We're going to press 50,000 copies. They're going to be $20 each, and we're going to do it on our own label. And that's the way you get the money. I mean, you cut out the friggin' middleman who's taking about a good 98% chunk of your money that you're getting.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, like, what do record labels do anymore?
Nothing.
You know, like...
Probably pony up the money for a tour, but, I mean, if you've got the money coming in from the record sales, you can fund your own damn tour these days.
But that's, like, I think bands, that's, like, their primary source of income now is touring, T-shirt money, you know? They're not making this money off of a...
Inadvertently, iTunes could be pretty much killing the record labels.
Yeah, I mean...
Because you can post your own podcast on iTunes... You know, granted, they're free.
Right. I mean, you know...
What's to stop you putting your own album up there? Or there's CD Baby as well, another site, which, you know, they'll press the CDs for you, and they take very, very minimal amount of money. And yeah, you
I mean, the only thing is promotion, like getting the stuff out there, press releases.
But shit, you've got social media for promotion. You've got your own... You got promotion at your fingertips these days. Sure. It's not like it was back in 89, 90, 91 before the internet came along.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you set up a Twitter account, you set up a Facebook account, you set up a Instagram, you get yourself a bunch of followers and you get retweets and shares and...
Sure, you just have to... What can a record company do besides that? I mean, there's a lot of people who don't... It's kind of funny, like, when you look at some bands, they really know how to use social media and some don't. Like Sebastian Bach has a ton of followers on social media, but his new album sold like shit, you know? Like, no one bought it.
Bach's stuff is shit, man.
Like, he posted on his social media site, he said, I have this many followers, but none of them bought the records. Like, do any of you guys really care, you know?
No, he acts like a 10-year-old whenever he's on a radio show or
it's true.
Yeah,
TV
exactly.
Show. Like, wow, he's out! Wow.
Hey, you mother guys. Trucker!
Come on, man! Come on!
Hey, I want to do a Skid Row reunion, but there's one guy in the band that's Bach-blocking me.
Yeah, I was going to say, you want to sell some records, Sebastian, get back in fucking Skid Row. That's about
your
only chance.
Yeah.
And get a haircut, for fuck's sake.
But yeah, so anyway, I was just thinking about that, and I was just thinking, like, man, you know, back when Van Halen was putting out an album every year, there's probably, you know, more money, more everything in it. But,
you know, well, radio was
they gave a shit about the artist back then, I dare say.
Radio was behind rock at the time and was behind pushing new artists. They're not really into that unless it's pop.
No, I mean, if you're not Katy Perry or Lady Gaga or, you know.
Right, it's like stuff for little girls. It's
yeah. Like Rihanna.
Stuff for 10-year-old girls. Nothing is pushed for like a teenage boy or adult male. Nothing. There's no music like that really pushed.
Or you got to be a fat South Korean named PSY if you want to get yourself on the radio or the TV.
And everything's gimmicky. It's kind of the American Idol, pop idol type idea with stuff. So
there's
meme look at the
song.
Look at the darkness. Look at the darkness when they came out. They were treated like a joke, but
yeah,
they weren't a joke. Far from it. Oh. There was just their influences were Queen, Thin Lizzy, bands that the generation these days didn't know. Oh,
right.
Look, they're being a parody of Queen, but they're not.
Didn't Lemmy slag them off, calling them like a novelty act or something?
Oh, yes, because Justin Hawkins called Lemmy an old C word, you know?
Yeah.
Pretty much. Well, yeah, basically. And so Lemmy's not really going to take to that too kindly, I guess.
Those are not as good as the Beatles.
Oi, you got to listen to the Beatles in mono. You know what I'm saying?
Bill, he's got a good point, though. They are faster.
You got to listen to them in mono. This box set says stereo.
I don't want double track George Harrison. I want the original mono pressing of George's work.
By the way, I collected Nazi knives. Bad guy's got the coolest shit, you know.
Yeah, I went and swapped a couple of black girlfriends with my son.
Oh, God. This is the creepiest part of that Lemmy doc.
I know, isn't it?
Like, there's no self-awareness at all when they talk about it.
God.
God. Anyway.
Yeah. Anyway. All right.
Well, that's a. Anything else you want to add, people? Anything? More Lemmy jokes? What?
No, I think we're done.
We're about done. Next week will be a little. It's still Rock Month, but it's going to be a little more movie centric. I know this one had fuck all to do with movies like last week, but
yeah.
It's still rock and roll. But
I can just hear the listeners out there going, "But Midnight Movie Cowboys, you're a film podcast.
You have movie in the title, you motherfuckers."
Yeah, like deal with it, Junior. We're being self-indulgent for a month.
We are being a little self-indulgent.
But yeah, like Hannah said, we are going to do be a bit more film-centric next week with John's pick.
Yes,
which we're going to give you not going to give you any clues what they are, Jet Boys, but you'll work out.
It'll be good. Although I am a little disappointed, Jesus fucking Christ,
if you can't get it from that.
It was originally going to be John Michael Thor, and I'm kind of bummed out we're not talking about that. But John has good reasons for switching, and I agree with them. So
it's because he got unfriended by John Michael Thor on Facebook, probably.
Yeah. John's upset. John, you still there? John's got the bubbles, so I think we lost John.
John got bubbles. Tiny bubbles. All right, see you, John.
All right. Anyways, we're just going to go ahead and sign out. All right. Adios.
Mahalo, people.
That was Stu imitating John.
Yeah, it's the only time I ever get the same hollow.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to Facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.